last week, as we started out this study, we just talked about some general information about the book itself, and then we spent most of our time talking about James which James is the actual author, at least believed to be the actual author of this letter. We talked about four different possibilities of James's that we find in the New Testament, and looked at each one of those and came to the conclusion that that I think is the proper one. Most scholars would agree that the author of this particular letter was James, the brother of Jesus. So this morning, as we finished talking about who the letter was written by, we want to start out this morning talking about who was the letter written to. Okay, who was the target audience? For this particular letter, there are some particular things about the letter itself that can give us an indication of perhaps who at least the original intended audience was with this. And one of those things is that it appears that James probably knew his audience fairly well. There are 14 different times in this letter that James refers to his readers as my brother or my brothers. There are three of those times where he specifically refers to as my beloved brothers. Now, some would say, well, that's still this kind of a general term, you know, for brethren, in the brotherhood and so on and so forth. Generally we kind of would refer to it that way, but back then probably not as much. The way that folks wrote back then in these kinds of writings really would kind of indicate more that he knew a little bit more about his original intended audience. Okay? If you look in the text, the second part of verse 1, it describes this audience that he's writing to as simply the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. Okay? So then the question becomes, that's who he's writing to, but specifically, who is that? Okay. Who makes up this, or who is this 12 tribes scattered among the nations? Well, they are probably Jewish Christians who were living outside of Palestine at the time. Okay, if you recall, and there's two scatterers, or is scattering a word? Scatterings? Is that a word? Two scatterings that we want to consider in this. I think the first one that probably most of us, if you're talking about people being scattered, would look at would be the what we read about in the book of Acts with the scattering that occurred with the persecution of Christians. When Stephen was stoned to death and Saul gave his approval, and then after that it tells us that the Christians, went everywhere from there. We were talking about that some last week. So certainly what we would see from that is that there are Jewish Christians, okay, who are scattered all over the place. They're no longer confined to Jerusalem. Okay? One of the things that we did mention last week in that, when that scattering took place, the result of that ultimately was that the gospel spread everywhere that the Christians went. They carried the word with them, and they shared it with other people, and so the gospel was spreading all over the known world at the time. So that is one scattering, so to speak, to consider in this in terms of the audience. The other scattering is that it took place way, 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 way back in Israel's history, back in, began actually in 721 B.C. The word that is used here in this for this scattering, some of your translations, if you have a King James translation, it probably uses the word dispersion. Okay, those who are part of the dispersion or the diaspora that began. By the Assyrians when they conquered the Israelite, the northern kingdom of Israel in 721 B.C., the Israelites were scattered among the nations. At that time, the nations that Assyria owned, okay, that they were ruling at that particular time.
A lot of them were taken off as slaves.
Exactly. The Babylonians continued that dispersion in 586 B.C. when they conquered the southern kingdom of Judah, and they did the same thing. The Assyrians, when they, you know, and they, again, they were the world power at that particular time, and their custom and the way they dealt with trying to prevent revolts and those kinds of things was that they would take the best of the people, the brightest, the healthiest, the youngest, the ruling class of people. They would take them captive, and would take them to other parts of the empire, and that's where they would live. And then what they would do is they would bring people from other nations that they had conquered into this region. So in other words, they took a lot of the Israelites out of the northern kingdom of Israel. Of course, we read about a couple of folks in the Bible during that particular time.
Daniel.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's a perfect example of what the Assyrians did. You see, and how they used them. They became officials under the king and so forth, you see. And so the Babylonians, when they became the world power, they conquered the Assyrians and they became the world power, they kind of continued the same idea. You see, if you take out the best and the brightest and the leaders of the people and you replace them with folks just from wherever they're from, other parts of the empire and so forth, then you have less of a chance of this nationality kind of a thing of folks going, hey, we're gonna rise up and rebel, because now what you've got is this mix of all kinds of people. Okay. Which also, by the way, is where we came about with another group of people that was known amongst the Jews that we read about in the New Testament, known as who? The Samaritans. Okay. Samaritans were the result of, they were basically half-breeds. They were Jews, you see, who were born to Jewish parents, part Jewish and part Gentile parents. You see, so they were not pure-blood Jews. They were part Jew, but not completely Jew. So therefore, the full-blooded Jews looked down upon them. But that's kind of a result of this dispersion idea. This get people and move them all around the empire. You know, take some of them and put them over here. Take some of those folks, put them over here. We kind of mix things all up and everything, and then we don't have as much of a chance of this national pride where people will rise up and say, "Hey, let's go against these folks and rebel and revolt." It worked pretty well for those empires. You see? So that dispersion, that was really the first one, so to speak, scattered Jews everywhere. Okay? All over the world. What we need to try to understand, and I guess maybe a question that we need to ask ourselves considering this in terms of who this audience really is first of all, is James's statement here Was that intended to be literal or figurative? Okay. In other words, it could be literal if James were speaking to Jewish Christians scattered outside of Palestine. In other words, those of the first scattering we talked about, the persecution and so forth. It could be literally that's who he's talking to referring about and so on and so forth. It could be figuratively, where he's figuratively speaking to all Christians that are scattered everywhere, not just Jewish Christians. Okay? Could be, you know, everybody. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16, there Paul refers to the church as the Israel of God. And so we have this idea and this concept that the New Testament speaks about of the church, the church of Christians are considered or looked upon by God, at least in one perspective, as Israel. Not that we are Jewish, but that we are in the form of Israel, God's chosen people. Okay, when you look at Revelation 21 verses 12 through 14, there. It talks about the 12 apostles that Jesus had chosen, and I don't know if you've ever really thought about it. Did you ever, you know, have you ever considered why did he choose 12? Why not 11? You know, why not 13? Okay. Well, in the big scheme of things, how many tribes were there amongst the Jews? There were 12 tribes, 12 sons of Jacob or Israel, made up the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, and so here we see Jesus choosing 12 apostles, and I don't think that was accidental. I think it was intentional. The reason I say that is primarily because after Judas hung himself, what did they do? They had to find a replacement, didn't they? Okay, so there would be 12. Well, we've talked about before the idea of numbers in the Bible, and 12 being one of those that is considered to be a complete number. So 12 represents the completeness, not only 12, but multiples of 12. So when he talks about the 12 tribes of Israel, then it's talking about the completeness. Not a literal number of people, but the complete number of Israelites that are represented. In other words, in Revelation, when it talks about the 144,000 that are there around the throne and so forth, what does that mean? Well, there are those today who interpret that and say, well, that means that only 144,000 people are actually going to go to heaven. Okay, the rest are going to live here in paradise on earth. Okay, well, if you take that literally, what it's saying there, then that means that only 144,000 Jews are going to be in heaven. Okay, because that's what it describes there of that 144,000, and it specifically says 12,000 from every nation of Israel. You see, and it goes through and it names 12,000 from each one of the nations, 144,000, 12 times 12. And so if you look at that literally, then that means none of us is going to heaven. Because we're not Jews. There's only 144,000 or 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel that are going to actually go to heaven. Right? But if you keep on reading, and he says, after that I looked and I saw a great number that no one could count. Men from every nation under heaven. Okay? Who's that talking about? Usans. Or weans. See? And so again, the idea is not a literal number, it's the representative, it's the complete. In other words, all of those of Israel who are going to be saved are going to be saved. And all of those amongst the nations, in other words, the Gentiles, it's not intended to be a literal number. And so here we have a similar kind of a thing. I don't think it's intended to be literal that he's only talking about the 12 tribes of Israel here. Okay? He's talking about, and I believe that he's talking about Jewish Christians, but whatever that number might be, the complete number of Jewish Christians, see, that are scattered wherever they are. Another possibility of all of this is Jewish and non-Jewish Christians that are scattered everywhere, and the nations would represent non-believers. Okay, Dale? I think you're exactly right. I think that does help us to narrow down at least his original intended audience, because it covers a couple of different things. We said at the beginning, James knew his audience very well, okay? And last week, as we were talking about the authorship, who the author was, we also looked at the fact that the way that he writes with this authority and so forth, it's most probable that his audience knew him very well and respected what he had to say. So that was one of the things that we talked about last week in terms of identifying, you know, which James it was. And it's the James, the brother of Jesus, who was part of and perhaps even probably was one of, if not the leader of the Jerusalem Council. You see. He was recognized as a prominent leader of the church in Jerusalem at that time. And so certainly these Jewish Christians who, when persecution broke out, as we said earlier, scattered everywhere around the world, they would have recognized him, would have known him in his words and so forth, would have recognized his authority to say the things that he was saying in this letter. Right. So, I think that we can look at this letter, this audience that he's talking about, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, a couple of different ways. Although what he wrote applies to all Christians everywhere, we'll talk about that in a little bit more here in just a moment, seems that his original intended audience was most likely those Jewish Christians there from Jerusalem that were scattered everywhere after the church began there in Jerusalem. So, again, part of the issue of that, how do we, you know, what are some other clues that we have to that is, if you look in verse 2, okay. And let's see. He says, chapter 2, verse 2, rather. I'm sorry, not verse 2. Chapter 2 and verse 2. The instructions that he gives here, he says, suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes and so forth. Some of your other translations say assembly, okay? And perhaps, who's got a King James translation? Anybody got a King James? What does it say there? What's the word it says there? Chapter 2, verse 2.
Use the whole thing to get context.
Yeah.
Well, if they should come unto your assembly, a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and if some and a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one wearing the fine clothes, and say to him, you sit here in the good place, and say to the poor man, stand there or sit here at my footstool, have you not shown partiality among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?
Okay. The part that I want to focus on here, does anybody have a translation that uses the word synagogue? Okay. That's the word that should be there. The synagogue. All right. In the original language, in the Greek, the word for assembly is ekklesia. It's the word that is translated assembly or church. Okay. And it literally means the called one. Okay. Ekklesia is not the word that is found in the original text in chapter 2 and verse 2. The word that is found there is the Greek word for synagogue. Okay? Now, why is that so significant? Because synagogues were Jewish places of worship. Okay? The word synagogue referred at that particular time, it referred to an assembly of Christian Jews, according to W.E. Vine. When you look at the word synagogue, it was really kind of a word that came about, again, during the time period of the dispersion. Okay, the original dispersion we were talking about. When people were scattered everywhere, when Jews were scattered everywhere all over the known world at the time, what could they no longer do in terms of worship? They couldn't go to the temple. Okay? And temple worship was so important to them that when the kingdom, the original kingdom of Israel divided into two kingdoms, the northern and southern of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah, what did Jeroboam, if I remember correctly, I always have a hard time remembering which one, Jeroboam or Rehoboam, what did Jeroboam, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, do? Anybody recall? Yeah. He set up two tabernacles, one in Dan and one in Bethel, you say, had the golden calf built and so forth, so that the people would not return to Jerusalem and worship there. They didn't have to go back there to worship. They had two places in the north that they could go to worship. Okay, that's how important and significant temple worship was to the Jews back then. Well, now they're scattered everywhere. They don't have any place to worship. So the synagogues in the Jewish communities really kind of developed as the center, not just of worship, but the center of Jewish life. They became not only the place to worship, but they became the center of education, and they became the center of Jewish government. Okay? Whatever city, whatever town or village or whatever, a community of Jews, they would have a synagogue, and it wouldn't necessarily be a nice building, church building, what we would typically think of as a church building, and certainly a lot of them not like synagogues that the Jews have today that you can find scattered all over, even here in America. But it was wherever they met as a community, say, for worship, for education, for the running of the government. The leaders of the Jews, that's where they kind of ran things, for amongst the people.
And they operated as a synagogue. Okay.
So the synagogue then, the use of that term that James has in this text, again, is a pretty strong evidence that his audience was primarily Jews, Jewish Christians, you say, rather than an audience primarily of Gentiles. Gentiles wouldn't have a whole lot of connection to the idea of a synagogue. Okay. That's one of the one example of sometimes how we can you know, little words that we find in the New Testament, the word, the meaning of a word that is so different than what we typically use, helps us to understand even a little bit more about what that particular message is all about. For us, we typically, when we talk about worship, we talk about going to church. Thank you. See? And we just kind of use it in a really broad sense in that way. For them, synagogue was the center of Jewish life. Okay? Any thoughts? I'm kind of been going on about all this stuff. Any thoughts or input or comments or on any of this at all? Questions?
Well, James is talking about coming to your assembly, King James Version assembly. That literally, the context of the message is if he comes into your presence and you treat someone as a, over another, then you don't wash out the other. Assembly is where you meet publicly or whether you come to your house. And two guys come in, two, one, different. Pretty common discrimination.
Yeah, in the context of that, when we get into the text itself and looking at that in application of it, I think you're exactly right. Okay. But in terms of being able to try to figure out who James's original intended audience was, that little bit of information helps us to kind of narrow it down a little bit. That again, he's primarily talking to Jewish Christians. Now we go back to the issue here that we brought up a few moments ago of this. Okay, if his original intended audience was Jewish Christians that were scattered all over the place, then how does the book of James, this letter that he wrote, or does it even apply to us today? Because we're not Jewish Christians scattered all over the place, are we?
But it was a circular letter.
Okay.
I mean, if it circulated amongst them, then why wouldn't it circulate amongst us?
Okay.
Message.
Precisely. Well, and not only that, but on the other side of that fence, though, is that those Gentiles who came from pagan temple worship tried to hold on to a lot of the things that they were used to doing. That's kind of what human beings do, you see, and so forth. So that's what Christian worship, when you try to define what it was back then, it was kind of a broad mix of things and so forth, right? Absolutely. So, you know, if you look at it from the standpoint that yes, back then there was a big emphasis on the difference between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. Okay, it's not so today. Okay. And not only that, but even when those things were written or to the original audiences, were there and are there things that we read in the New Testament that are exceptions? In other words, these are things that are expected only of Jewish Christians, and Gentile Christians don't have to follow these rules, or vice versa. Okay? In other words, that God's law applies to all men equally everywhere. It doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile. It doesn't matter, you see. Now, again, there are traditions that were followed and things of that nature, but those were not God's commands of how he wanted his church to be, the things that apply even today to all Christians, you see. Those things apply, so the instructions that James gives, the wisdom that he gives here, okay, is not exclusively Jewish in nature. It's Christian in nature. Does that make sense? You see? So it applies then to Christians anywhere, everywhere, even today. Chuck, you had up a moment ago?
Aren't there some sects that are trying to be Jewish, Christians that are trying to be Jews, and trying to take
you
all
have,
those customs,
yes,
feeling like that might put them in better shape for some reason, or that's what he,
well,
he kind of leans towards the Jewish Christians rather than the Gentiles. Maybe just wants to do that.
We want favoritism and so forth.
They either feel better about themselves than someone else, or they feel bad.
Well, one of the things that you have to understand is that Judaism is a little bit different in terms of how we look at it, because Judaism is not just a religion, it is also a nationality. Okay, and that's one of the things you have to keep in mind. So people were Jews, you see, by birth. Okay, that was their nationality as a people, but then Judaism was also their religion, their faith. It was all, and that was how God intended for it to be. You don't make a distinction, you see, between, you know, how you're supposed to live for God. It's, you know, I'm a Jew. And what did that mean? Well, it was intended by God to mean that you belong to him, period, in all aspects of your life. So what that means is today, because you have a large segment of the Jewish population that are still not only Jewish nationally, but they are Jewish religiously, they still cling to the old law, at least the parts that they're allowed to practice and so forth. They don't do the sacrificial system and everything. But they deny Christ as the Messiah. They have not accepted him. So in that respect, they are religious Jews. But amongst the Jewish people as a nation, there are what are referred to as Messianic Jews. That is, those who have accepted Jesus as the Messiah. They're Christians. They're Christian Jews. Just like those that we read about, you know, in the first century. They're still Jewish by nationality, but religiously they are Christians. Okay? And then you do have within those, you've got some different, just like you have with Christians today on all kinds of different denominations. You got, you know, Southern Baptist, you got this Baptist, this Baptist, you got Church of Christ that's conservative, Church of Christ that's liberal, you got, you know, and you got all kinds of flavors and varieties of people that have, Brian, as you mentioned earlier, traditions and things that have become their laws and rules, and, you know, and we don't agree on that, so we're going to separate and go start our own group, and, you know, we're associated with them, but we're not associated with them, kind of a thing, you see. That's why we have so many different denominations of churches and Christians all over the world, you see. That's basically how it comes about. But the bottom line is, the letter that James wrote, he wrote to Christians. Okay? His original audience were those Jewish Christians that he knew and knew him very well. Okay? But the things that he shares equally applies to all Christians everywhere. Okay? Wherever they would find themselves. We have a few more minutes. Let me try to finish this particular part of it. The very first topic that James ventures into has to do with suffering. Okay? And much of this letter actually deals with the issue of Christians suffering, as he describes all kinds of trials. Okay? Much of the suffering that Christians back then experienced was as poor people who were being oppressed by the rich. And that's part of the text that Jerry read for us a few moments ago over in chapter 2. So he's talking about those folks who are struggling and suffering, being oppressed by others. And oftentimes those others are people within Christianity themselves. Okay? He's also talking about under this idea of suffering and suffering trials and so forth, he's talking about the dispossessed. Okay? As we said a few moments ago, James's original audience are probably Jewish Christians who are far removed from their homes and they are living in strange lands and hostile environments where they are being oppressed. And so James's goal is to provide wisdom so that those dispossessed Christians who are suffering all kinds of trials will know how they should respond and react under those circumstances. Now, here's a question. Does this describe us? Okay. In other words, in answering the question of who the audience is, okay, as we talked about, okay, originally his audience most likely was those Jewish Christians from Jerusalem that were scattered everywhere, but what about us today? Does the things that James is writing about to that original audience, do they describe us today as God's people? You see, I think sometimes it's probably difficult for us to relate to some of the circumstances that they had to relate to. We live in nice, comfortable homes. We have air conditioning in the summertime and heat in the wintertime. We drive nice cars. Who among us does not have at least one cell phone? And perhaps probably the latest and greatest cell phone, you see. We have all of the latest technology and all of the latest conveniences. It hardly seems, in other words, that we fit into the profile of the poor, suffering, dispossessed people that James was originally talking to. So then the question becomes, what relevance is there to us in what James has to say?
Well, if we don't fit in that category, so James is saying we fit in the other category.
Okay, all right. Tommy South says this in his book on this. He says, we may do well to learn to live as though we were, because it may not be long before we are the dispossessed. Okay? So in other words, we may be comfortable right now, but how long is that going to last? Let me read to you a passage, a little bit lengthy, not too long, but I want to read this to you that he has to say about this particular topic. He says, although we may not be among the world's dispossessed, we would do well to learn to live as though we were, because it may not be long until we are. There are ways other than economic oppression to be on the fringes of your culture. And that's really what being dispossessed is all about. Okay? He says, American society has done a drastic turnaround in the past 50 years in its attitude toward Christian faith. Many of us grew up in a world where both our faith and our scriptures were respected, even by those who did not themselves pay much attention to them. In our lifetimes, we have seen such activities as daily Bible reading in public schools go from being normal to being criminal. Our society is rapidly turning not just away from a Christian worldview, but against that worldview and the faith which underlies it. Whereas Christians once battled indifference toward Christ, we now face increasing hostility toward Him. Tenets of basic morality are now not only ignored, but are responded to in anger from those who refuse to be bound by any moral requirements. If these trends continue, and there is every reason to believe they will, then we who believe will continually find ourselves marginalized by our culture. Already, there are those who actively seek to suppress what we believe, which means that if they get their way, we will become the oppressed minority in our society. That being the case, we not only can find something of value in James, we desperately need the wisdom he offers. We need his wisdom for the dispossessed every bit as much as did his first readers. So who was the book of James written to? Just as much as it was written to that original Jewish Christian audience back then, it was written for us today. Again, I think one of the difficulties for us in looking at James is we see the things that they were struggling with and we go, well, yeah, but it's not us today. Heed these words. He is quickly becoming us today, where we are being pushed further and further and further out to the fringe of our culture. If you just stop and take a moment, and we're going to finish up with this. I don't know how many of you have been watching the stuff that's going on in Houston. With the ministers there have been subpoenaed by the city council. Mayor, who is a lesbian, is behind the whole thing, that they have subpoenaed the sermons, and when the Attorney General of Texas told them they were out of line, they said, okay, we won't subpoena their sermons, we'll subpoena their speeches. Anything that had to do, well, what is a sermon? Say, anything that had to do with the law that they passed allowing for anyone to use any restroom they want to. If a man identifies as a woman, he can use women's public restrooms if he wants to, and women can do the same thing, and so forth. There was an uproar over that, and a lawsuit filed against the city because the city squashed a petition saying it wasn't legitimate. So they filed a lawsuit, and these ministers, who actually have no part of the lawsuit itself, have been targeted by the city. Okay? And these subpoenas issued for their sermon. Where we're going, folks? Where we're going?
You should have been home.
Yep. You speak out against these folks. going to be a backlash. Their whole goal is to push Christianity, which speaks out against what they represent, is to push us as far out in society as possible so that we can no longer stand against them. So we need to pay attention to what James has to say. Next week we will begin actually looking at the text itself. All right? Thank you all very much.